The next person that we welcome is Judge Frank. I was testing the microphone this morning and I sang a little bit. Judge Frank also knows how to sing.
I sang back to him.
Yeah, if he runs out of words about the law, he can always give us some tunes. Here's Judge Frank.
I'll get my watch out because Luann Blake said, I will gong you if you don't stay within your feet. She didn't really say that, but I want to be respectful to my fellow panelists and each of you. As you know, we are supposed to chat about our perspective from the bench and specifically what you should anticipate as lawyers and I suppose as clients of the assumptions, oftentimes negative stereotypical assumptions that the judge or jury may have. Let me say at the outset, I would suggest that a case-by-case approach, we have to be aware and know your judge, know the jury pool, but it's very difficult to address case-by-case negative stereotypes in my experience once a case is in the system proceeding to trial. And so what is my suggestion? It won't come as a surprise to anyone. Much more effective, and you've heard the judge talk about it, a proactive educational approach with children, schools, legal profession, judges, the courts, schools, and the society in general. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that and some of the things that I've been fortunate enough, thanks to a number of disability advocates, to work on and working on as I speak. On the other hand, it's truly a privilege, and I've still got a lot to learn, but I'm in my 28th year as a judge, the last 14 in the federal bench, and it's truly a privilege to watch a lawyer who doesn't carry these negative stereotypes of individuals with disabilities or other stereotypes, come into the courtroom, zealously pick a jury, competently pick a jury, but to do it with an understanding and sensitivity of their client. What do I mean by that? Years ago, you'd see in state and federal court, lawyers come in and maybe they were focusing on the damage claim, and they would maximize the dysfunction, maximize and try to take the pity and entitlement route. And sometimes, depending on the stereotypes held by many jurors, if not outright discrimination, it disproportionately and adversely affected individuals with disabilities, regardless of disability. Today, you can see what's happened with the legal profession, with few exceptions. They're tried differently, the cases. They come in right out of the block, and you got to know your judge, because in at least in federal court, in most federal judges, I wouldn't fit the mold. Many federal judges don't allow the lawyers to ask any questions at voir dire. I usually allow at least 15 minutes each or more, but I have them submit questions to me in advance, and I rarely, if ever, don't ask them myself. And you know right away if the lawyer is in tune and not carrying these stereotypes and truly respects her client, because then when they try their case, they first start with enhancing and emphasizing, this is the extraordinary talent and ability of my client. And for liability and damage purposes, they don't minimize the lack of reasonable accommodation or the what the discrimination has been because of the particular disability, but they talk about truly letting the jury know their client. And so these stereotypes, depending on how embedded they are, and I'll talk about that in a moment, can fall away. And so I see lawyers doing that today, and they didn't do it some years ago. But come back with me, if you would. I just want to reminisce the last couple of years, because I think it relates to the stereotype issue and how it manifests itself in the courtroom. And I would say that even if I wasn't winding down a class action by all intellectually disabled folks or individuals with intellectual disabilities who were drugged up, tied up, thrown up, secluded in Minnesota in two state hospitals, the class action, and I'll talk a little bit about that, where I've individually written letters at the request of plaintiff's counsel to each of the 200 class members, and talk to them. And now I'm fighting with the Social Security Administration because they think they should have the money, even though the most profound relief is the injunctive relief of changing the treatment program. Or I may still say a couple of things about some special moments the last couple of years. I happen, even though most lawyers in the room know that cases are truly random assignment, I have the class action of all the 650 sex offenders who have been civilly committed in Minnesota. No one's been released since 1994. And so I get the inside glimpse, you might say. But come back with a moment, and even though my colleague over here is going to, talk about how we're seeing more of the constitutional promise of equal justice under law kept in light of some of the attention around the 20th anniversary of the ADA and the AD amendments and the EEOC regulations that followed those amendments and the broad protections that Congress really intended from the beginning to stamp out disability discrimination. Let me talk about a couple things that I think are affecting how cases are tried in my part of the country, and in talking with some of you earlier today, I think maybe across the country. The Federal Bar Journal, one of the largest publications for federal lawyers and judges, focused on disability law in September of 2010. In fact, when they profiled me, I said, I'll do it if you promise to focus on disability law. Well, one of the things, and they kept their promise. For example, Mr. David Furlinger, who's in the audience, he was asked to write an article for that called Disabilities in Law, The Evolution of Independence. He wrote that. Now, because of my good friend who's devoted to disability initiatives and a very prominent lawyer in Minnesota at the Robbins Kaplan firm, Becky Thorson, who's on the editorial board for the Federal Lawyer, and because of disability advocates saying to me, don't go to Washington and use the word diversity until they broaden the definition of individual disability. So I've gone to Washington to the federal bar in Asheville and said, I can't return to Minnesota until we broaden it. Well, the federal bar is now in November, December, and watch and keep an eye out for this coming year. They've said, take the whole issue, Judge Frank, for disability. Take it all. It's yours. And so Becky Thorson is on the editorial board. The entire, and we're kind of surveying the country, but they've given us the entire issue for later this year. But let me talk about the stereotype issue in presenting cases, whether it's case-by-case context, and what we're trying to do, thanks to some people have influenced me, before I conclude my remarks. We've done free CLEs for over 600 lawyers in the last year, and we have 700 more scheduled starting in just a couple of weeks. And what we're doing is we are taking talking about disability discrimination, because we were having a hard time getting lawyers represent people in Social Security cases, hard time in housing discrimination, and we're doing two things. We're expecting private law firms to donate 2 hours at a time for a luncheon, and then three or four of us are coming in and we are speaking about the lack of representation and access to the justice system. And we've been doing that for the last year and a half. And how we're doing it, as a federal judge, I can appropriately ask for Cypre money. So we've raised $700,000. We've hired a full-time person. It's called our Pro Se Project Litigator. The ABA last year, deserving or not, gave us the award for the project. And even in cases unrelated to disability discrimination, I've had the national MDL case for Boston Scientific and Guidant. I said, the Cypre Fund, I expect a $100,000 donation to the Pro Se Lawyer Project, and our emphasis is on disability discrimination. And so that's what we've been doing, and I'm going to make a confession here. In being invited to this seminar and trying to talk about what this full-time person lawyer we have that is training lawyers, and we'll go in and talk to about 200 lawyers at a time, and we have an EEOC lawyer, the head of the EEOC division in the Midwest, who works with us, and the head of the civil division for the U.S. Attorney's Office, because they have 50 cases currently under investigation for ADA complaints that have been filed that they receive and pursue on public accommodation issues, and so they're working with us. We started using a group called Interact, and if you Google Interact, it's a full-time theater group that only employs at much more than minimum wage, and they don't try to use the exception to the minimum wage law. Only people with disabilities, so if they have everyone from totally blind, totally deaf, intellectual disabilities, other physical disabilities, and they are a theater group, and so we've been asking them. We give elimination of bias credits, and they come into our CLEs, and they put on half-hour presentations. I can't even tell you the number of lawyers that have come up and said, we had no idea we've been carrying around these stereotypes. We're so sorry. These folks have opened our eyes. But getting ready for this and thinking about that, I went back, I'll admit it, and I read the namesake here, Jacobus Tenbroek's 1966 law review article in the California Law Review, The Right to Live in the World, a Disabled Law of Torts. Amazing when you think how many years before, not for many of you, it was amazing to me, long before thoughts of the ADA, here he is saying, integrationism is a policy entitling the disabled to full participation in the life of the community, encouraging, enabling them to do so. It's just amazing, because as a young prosecutor in the 1970s, I learned hard time doing many, many cases, because for the wrong reasons, a lot of mediocre, lazy lawyers. That's not true today in a lot of those offices. I did lots of sexual assault and other cases where the victims were blind, deaf, intellectually disabled, and I learned there that bringing victims to the courtroom, same is true for plaintiffs in a civil lawsuit, introduce them to the judge, let them sit in the witness chair. Actually, where I was trying cases, there'd been so many immigrants in the Iron Range that they had two chairs together in the courtroom so you could have a support person, although that was tended initially for an interpreter. But I learned to familiarize my clients, the victims, with the courtroom, bring them in, introduce them to everybody, never had a judge decline. I do the same thing today as a federal judge. I did it the same. And to familiarize himself and bring them in and actually ask for the courtroom to be, I have lawyers do it now, the courtroom to be theirs for an hour or more before they pick a jury and the week before the case. And many of you know better than I do that familiarizing oneself with that and that lowers some of the anxiety. But let me end with a couple things. 2 years ago, I was picking a jury in what was going to be a 4 to 6 week heavy document case. And there on the jury pool was a totally blind woman. And the questioning was done, and I said, counsel, approach the bench. I said, you weren't thinking, were you, of excusing that jury for cause or trying to, because I can't see any reason to excuse her. Can you? No, Your Honor, no. Well, since you're here, and I said, if you object to something I'm going to say, we'll put it on the record. I said, I'm assuming also you're not going to try to exercise a peremptory challenge, because I said, I think you'd be rising, I'm assuming one of you would raise a Batson challenge. I said, I think you'd only be excusing her because she's blind. Anybody, I assume you will not be doing that, will you? No, Your Honor, we won't. More importantly, she sat on the jury. I tailored the jury instructions and with the jury, so when the documents went up on the screen, they were explained and summarized. The trial was over, and I did what most state and federal judges do. I meet with the jury. They reach the proper verdict, and here's what the other 11 jurors said to me. Judge, and I've got the quote, we are... thank you for the opportunity of serving on this jury. We are sorry that so many assumptions that we didn't know we had for so many years about people who are blind, they're all wrong. She saw things we'd never see, that we didn't see. We were a better jury today because of her participation. We might start believing in equal justice. We wondered about it, and we really might start believing in it. And I was taught, in conclusion, I want to save, if Luann won't call me, I'm a little bit over, I think. But I want to actually save, for me personally, the most important story that relates to yes, it affects how I try cases, it affects how I treat lawyers, it affects how I treat people. During the last year, you heard me mention that we're doing these CLEs with an emphasis on training lawyers, educating them to get them more interested in either taking cases, and actually it's through our volunteer program, a very experienced class action lawyer is handling one of these class actions now I have in Minnesota in the federal court. But in the last year, and I wished I could tell you it was my idea, it was not. We've completely changed how we present the CLEs. In fact, next week we'll be presenting it to 250 lawyers at the State Attorney General's office because they've kind of privately admitted we need to educate our lawyers. We've got stereotypes in the hallways, in our rooms. We need your help. And I was approached by some non-lawyer disability advocates and said, why is it all these, you have nothing but so-called experts on the panel. Why don't you have the class members themselves, people who have struggled with the being judged by stereotypes and discrimination all their life, since you invite all these folks to your courtroom and have tours, which I do because I've called a number of disability centers and sheltered workshops and said it's their courthouse too. Why don't we have educational sessions with them? It's their courthouse. They should be coming in here just like college students, grad students. So all you do has to ask. I've had every group in the Twin Cities in my courtroom in the last, but I've got to meet a lot of very special people. Well, I've met someone who's been trained as a self-advocate, Karen, who's 52 years old. She's intellectually disabled, can't read or write except her name, draws in symbols, so if she wants to tell you, I feel like I have the same feelings as you, she'll put a heart up on the screen when we're, I like friends just like you do. She'll put two people holding hands up on the screen, she'll draw it. Well, with her permission and her parents' permission, she and I, not my idea, she's been participating in the last two panels. She'll be with me with these 200, training 200 lawyers in another week. We sit and have a conversation for about 30 minutes is what it's designed to do. And it's unbelievable. And it won't be to many of you here. So we have a conversation, and she, not me, she has broken down these stereotypes for all these lawyers. Here's the reactions that I get. They come up afterwards. Can we sign up? Can we sign up to take cases? Who do we talk to? We had no idea we were carrying around these assumptions and these stereotypes. And now listening to Karen and hearing that she thinks and feels like all the rest of us and we were making these judgments. And so she's got a great sense of humor. Here's how she typically leaves off a panel now that she's confident. You know, Judge Frank, he's much better than Judge Judy, but if he's this big federal judge, why isn't he getting me a job where I can use my brain at the federal courthouse? So she's taught me what equal justice under the law is and what my oath means. So sorry to have gone over. Thanks for not gonging me.